Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to have a very challenging topic to many, not challenging to myself or to my guest. However, when I think we hear these words, we say, oh, I don't want to go down that road. It might seem like it's maybe something scary, it's something you don't want to hear about, something you don't want to talk about. But really, when we share our experiences, we share our challenges and all of our fears, sometimes it actually helps connect us to others who might be running in fear and hiding it and holding on to it and feeling less than, not in place in this world. And really, our goal here is to let everyone know the world is a safe place. There are people to talk to. There are people out there who are willing to listen and just find them and reach out. Today, my guest is Jax Anderson, and he is going to be talking about his new book called Semi-Viral and his experiences in life. We are going to be talking about harassment, bullying, drugs, sex, violence, and self-doubt. Who hasn't delved into some of those? I'm in my 60s, been down those roads a few times myself. I think a lot of people will say, well, I'm not quite willing to own up to that, but oh yeah, maybe I should have learned something. Maybe I should have done something differently. Maybe I should have helped someone out. Maybe I wish someone helped me out. That's what our purpose is today. Jax, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here, Dr. Jeanette. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk.
So don't you think your thoughts on what I had to say that we think that we really need to share?
Oh, yeah. I think, that's really the first step to finding any sort of help, really, is being willing to share or admit that, you know, there's something going on.
I think sometimes the hiding can get you into such a dark hole that you can't find a way out. You know, today I just noticed on social media they posted that I live in New Orleans, that in the state of Louisiana, the number of opioid prescriptions that have been written will outweigh the population and then some, including babies. So if you take everyone that's been born or that's living in the state of Louisiana and give them an opioid prescription, there's even more than the population. Can you believe that? And we wonder where we're at in this world.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. That's part of I think that's definitely part of the problem is how easy it is to get, you know, opiates.
Yeah, you know, don't you think that, let's start at the beginning. Where does bullying even come up? You know, I have four kids. They've all experienced it, and it has been different levels, different escalation problems. It was even before the internet and now after it.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I mean, you read a little bit about my story, but I think I dealt with my bullying. I think it hit me the most when I moved as a young kid, and, you know, kids want to fit in. And
right.
Some kids, I was one of them, are a little more socially awkward than others. When I first moved, I actually had a teacher who I found out during college when she gave a seminar that she had picked two students in each of her classes to really make the example of, and I was one of the first students that, you know, was made an example of, and students saw that, and, you know, it turned into, you know, they were very sarcastic with me, and they'd, you know, repeat things that made me mistakes I'd made and bring them up. I think the sarcasm really is one of the biggest things that, you know, starts bullying and harassment. I know that I kind of turned into a bully for a little bit in high school even because I grew up with all the sarcasm the kids around me would use, and I didn't understand it. My parents didn't use sarcasm at home at all. We were very straightforward and honest, and so when people were sarcastically rude to me, I didn't see the sarcasm. And then when I tried to, you know, call it out, then I became that weird kid out who couldn't, you know, speak sarcastically.
Right.
And sarcasm, you know, it can get carried away, and you know, people don't always understand what you mean when you're being sarcastic, and you don't want to admit that you don't understand what the cool kids are talking about.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes I've always said that harassment, sarcastic, and a lot of bullying is actually an adult problem because the adults are teaching the children how to do it. It's not necessarily that kids are born that way and they learn it. They get it from somewhere else, and the adults are really, really a problem. I mean, it is a big deal to be able to say that, you know, they're really harassing, and adults do this all the time.
Oh, yeah. I've seen multiple times, even friends that I grew up with, just how sarcastic their families would be. And, you
yeah.
know, some people you get their sarcasm, other people you don't. And another side of it, even, too, with some parents is they don't want to admit that their kid took it too far. You know, when I first learned sarcasm, I was one who, I mean, I had to practice it to get it. And, you know, sometimes I took it too far being sarcastic. And my parents were very willing to let me know when I'd gone too far, but I had, you know, met some friends whose parents are very unwilling to admit that their kid was a bully. They didn't want to go down that road. They didn't want to admit it themselves. And in a sense, that enabled the kid to become a bully and kind of empowered, you know, their ability to be more sarcastic, more rude, and it stopped being sarcastic. It started being more, you know, of a power trip.
Yeah, you know, you get these parents that always say, you know, hey, no one's going to hit my kid. I teach my kid to man up. I teach him to, you know, stand up, you know, knock those kids down. Nobody can get in your way. And I think sometimes parents learn that themselves from the way they grew up is that, you know, the world is a dog-eat-dog kind of world. And, you know, you just got to keep climbing that ladder and, you know, take no prisoners. So I think there's a great deal of the population that really grew up that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, I mean, just in my own youth, we had a gang problem pretty bad with drugs and stuff. And I actually got involved pretty young, I think 6 years old, when I first ran into methamphetamines. I'd get paid just on the schoolyard. High school kids would come over and offer $5 to, you know, six-year-old first grader to just go drop a baggie off for somebody. And, you know, you kind of get sucked into the culture. And it is adults, like, I mean, all growing up from then until, you know, even my adulthood now, I still see, you know, there are adults who don't want to leave their childhood habits, and they pull other kids into it. They want to feel young, they want to feel cool, but they don't want to take responsibility for that. And it really leads to, you know, it confuses children. It confused me. It led to my depression. You know, I didn't understand who to trust anymore. I had grown up thinking that I could trust adults. You know, my parents told me, you're ever in trouble, you know, find an adult, tell them what's going on. But there was a point where I hit where the adults were the ones that were the bullies or, you know, part of the problem. And you couldn't go to an adult. And I stopped trusting a lot of people altogether.
You know, and I think that's a core belief is that where is your value, your trust, your soul, where can you find comfort, safety, security, and stability in life? And that's a pretty tough place to be when all those start to become eroded. And I think they become eroded, you know, as you grow up and your parents will say, ah, you don't need that. You don't need that, you know. I can remember I had said, oh, I love you to my kids when I was leaving going to work. And a relative was in the same room, and they said, don't you ever say that again. That don't you ever listen to that. That's a falsehood, you know. And it really set the kids up to say, ooh, you know, but we really like to go along with that other relative, you know. Maybe we should start believing him. And they did. And that kind of really pulled that away from the belief system of who's right and who's wrong. And is it really right or wrong, or is it really what should be or shouldn't be, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's a real confusing thing. I think it got harder for me is that when I hit high school, when I started to learn that my own parents, you know, had their faults. And my parents are good people, but as I started to learn their mistakes that they, you know, didn't find, you know, I don't think, you know, they didn't notice I was noticing, or, you know, even when I did call it out, you know, they were trying to be parents and parents make mistakes, but it was hard for me to really be like, hey, now who do I trust, you know? You're telling me this, but I got all my friends and their parents doing this, and I hadn't had their experiences, so it was real hard for me to really accept that my parents had flaws, and when I did, I took it a whole other direction than I probably should have and really rebelled against them.
Well, you know, I live in New Orleans, and, you know, this is the land of let the good times roll. And, you know, when my kids, just two of my kids grew up here, and I'll tell you, it was seriously a problem because parents drink all the time, kids drink all the time, and I'm saying middle school. And it's in the house all the time, and you say to people, we're going to go to that function. Well, I don't want to drink. Well, then you don't go, you know. And everything is revolved around an open bar. Booze is always free. After Hurricane Katrina, it was three drinks and one appetizer for $10, you know. So really this concept of how things are set up in our lives and what is evolved in our environment as to what we'll be exposed to as our gateway, as our entry point, you know. And I also look at after Katrina, now we're like 12 years out, and we say, why is the violence so bad here? There's so many gangs. Women are getting thrown out of cars on the highway, and then cars run over them and dismember them. Women are, when they're in their eighth month of being pregnant, the boyfriends are coming along killing them and the babies because they don't want to be bothered. Or why is, you know, pizza delivery people getting shot just for the fun of the gang, you know? They didn't even rob them of the $40 he had in his pocket. They just felt like it. So I think this mentality is, what is the gateway? Where are we going? And what is that real crux in the world that we're forgetting about? Because I think we are almost like, as I would say, letting the good times roll and just taking whatever and anything out of the world and just having a good old time at the expense of others.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, too. I grew up in Ogden, which is in Utah, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, you know, I mean, we have a gang problem, and it's worse than people are willing to admit. But
mm-hmm.
we're also, you know, we're not, you know, Southside LA or nothing. We're Utah, Mormonville, Utah. But what people don't understand, especially, you know, parents, is that we hear about this gang culture in other states, and if you're not living in it, you aspire to be it. I was locked up as a kid for depression. We actually had a kid who went there with me who talked about how he aspired to live in the ghetto. And, you know, that's what people wanted to do. And you get these, when I moved, as a kid, I moved to a richer neighborhood. My parents, you know, the plan was to get us away from the crap of Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
But in effect, I actually think the people in the group I ran into afterwards were a little worse because they aspired to do what the gangsters in Ogden were doing. They wanted to sell drugs. They wanted to smoke drugs. And not only did they want to do it and be violent, they had the money to do it. They had the money to do it. They had the freedom to do it. Their parents didn't want to admit their kids can do anything. And we actually had, just a couple of years ago, a girl that went to school with my younger brother get murdered in our nice little, you know, rich, you know,
mm-hmm.
suburbia neighborhood that people didn't want to admit there was a problem. But, you know, we had a white supremacist crew that overdosed at a party with a girl and ended up killing her and hiding her body. And it was a big deal for several months. And I think that was a hard awakening for a lot of the people in the North Ogden Pleasantview area because they had to admit that, you know, this lifestyle isn't just something you see on the news in other areas. This is something that people actually want to do. They grow up seeing it. They listen to their music. And I listen to a lot of different music too. Like, I wasn't that kid. I wanted to aspire to be violent and tough and sell drugs. Right. And that was the way to do it. That was the only way to do it, realistically, in high school. That's all anybody aspired to do. And anyone with other ambitions just seemed too unrealistic. That wasn't easy enough. You couldn't touch that now.
Yeah, and it really here it's about the gangs are, you have to get yourself, you have to do something that will really blow the people's minds. In other words, get enough press. You know, how big and how absurd can it be? You know, stuffing women in a garbage can along the highway, you know, or all on the exits, or, you know, things like that. Or let's shoot the cops just because they felt like it or whatever, you know.
And oh, yeah.
I think that that's really, we might say that this is not happening in other areas, but I would definitely encourage listeners to say, listen to the underculture, listen to what your kids are saying behind a closed door, if you can, or listen to what other kids might sit down and tell you, because it is going on in all social, economic levels. This is not just for the poor. This is not just for the downtrodden or the black or the gangs or this, that, or the other. It's everywhere. Yes?
Oh, yeah. It absolutely is. I mean, I think it's something that parents, they need to be willing to talk to their kids about, too, and not, you know, not judge them when they hear things come up, but be very honest. I think one of the hardest things for me growing up was my parents are real good, are religious people, so I kind of gave up on my church for a while there because I had done so much that I felt I couldn't get back from. And to me, my parents had never made mistakes for a while, or they weren't as bad as mine. But being able to, my little brother actually had a lot of the same issues I did. I kind of pulled him into it as a kid, and I took responsibility for my influence on that. And one day when he was locked up, I went in there, and instead of hiding everything like I normally do, I admitted to him a lot of my faults, a lot of things that I had done that I know he's, you know, dabbled in, and really admitted to him, you know, why they were bad and why, you know, why I screwed up. I think at the point we were talking, I believe it was about sex, and I was able to tell him, you know, I had a couple scares. I had some woman who hated me that I will never know for sure if they have my kid or not. You know, and I was a scary guy as a kid, and I really told him that. I owned up to that and told him, you know, you gotta be careful with this because it's fun now, and your friends think you're cool, but these friends are gonna leave you in a year or less. They're not real friends, and then you're stuck with all the damage you've done and nobody to come to help you. And it's a dark reality,
truth.
And kids don't see that.
That they're just there for the fun too. You got to remember that they're just there for the rush. They're not there to settle out and, you know, be your best buds. They'll be your best buds because they want the rush just for the moment. They're on to the next high that they can get, whatever that might be. You know, watching you screw up or watching them screw up, whatever that might be. And I think that's seriously important to point out, is that it's not about what you can do for them. It is about what you could do for them. It's not about what they can do for you. You know, they're all about, you know, hey, you know, take it kind of life.
Oh, yeah. I think that was a big realization for me when I was, I believe, 17. So I'd been in rehabilitation for depression and a suicide attempt at 15, and I was forced to go in at that point. My parents had found out. They had to find out. It was at school, and school called my parents, and they took me to the ER, and I was forced. I pretty much put in handcuffs and taken into rehabilitation for depression. And I just, you know, I played by the rules. You know, I did what they told me to do because I had to, not because I wanted to. And when I got out, I got right back into my life. So there was a point when I turned 17 that I got involved with a gang retaliation. And pretty much got into a bit of a war with a group of kids that ended up getting me pretty beat up. And when the ambulance showed up and my dad showed up, you know, I was too scared. They knew what happened. I kind of lied about it, but they knew I was lying because I'd busted my face up. And on the car ride home, I told my dad in the car that I just kind of broke down. I told him what happened. I told him, you know, I can't do this anymore. And I asked to get locked up again. I told him I need to go back to rehab.
Right.
But the second time, I think the reason I was able to turn around is because I admitted to myself, you know, I needed help. I didn't do anything different the second time than I did the first time, other than admit that, you know, I needed it. I stopped hanging out with those friends that really got a high off hanging out with me, because I can't help them if I'm not doing well myself. If I got to let them go for a little bit, I let them go for a little bit, and I got to bring myself up and pull, you know, show them that it can be done.
You know,
and
I think sometimes
good friends that way.
Sometimes when people try to really put them in rehab, it's sort of because they a parent, let's use an example, wants to put a child in rehab because they want the child to, quote, conform. And so at any point, that's going to always fail. That's a 100% failure rate. If you help a child and use listen to my choice words, if you help a child get into rehab, then the child will learn that they want that. That's different because the parent is helping, not commanding, they conform, and the child is doing it because they want it, not because they are commanded to do such. And that is two totally different levels of compliance at two totally different levels of acceptance in how the process is going to go forward. Because if you're commanded to do something, well, sure as hell, I'm not going to do it. Don't tell me what to do. You know, even I say that myself, you know, and I'm not in those places in different times. You know, I'm not going to do something someone else is going to tell me because I want to, you know, they want me to do it. So just as much as if they put you in rehab, just as much as if you're in a gang, just as much as if you want to take the drugs. There are those that will follow, there's that will do. But then there's also the idea when it comes to you're just done, you can't do it anymore, you need help, and you want to be able to do it. So all of those little steps along the way to try to change you may or may not have worked, but until you wanted it and you accepted the help, that's when it really will start to work, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the key there is, you know, parents have got to be doing something. I think my parents did some things differently with me than they did with my brother, and some things, you know, didn't work with me that may have worked with someone else. So I'm putting me in rehab the first time, you know, didn't work for me. But at the same time, you know, I figured out that it existed. I think that was something that a lot of parents don't realize is there is a place to get help, and they've got to be able to talk to their kids about it. And you know, I don't know if I was worse or better after the first attempt, but after I knew it existed and I chose to go in, it really makes a huge, huge difference. And a lot of kids get caught up in they want to talk. I don't know anyone who's got depression that doesn't want to talk, but the way to talk about it, you know, there's a right and a wrong way. I think a lot of kids, especially during my high school, they go to, there's cutting was a huge thing. Self-harm was a huge thing. And then going and telling your friends about it and trying to, you know, I think the issue that a lot of people get, and this kind of goes back to the bullying a little bit, is people see kids who are, we call it emo growing up.
Mm-hmm.
They're cutting themselves and they're talking about how sad they are all the time. And kids, tell each other, oh, they're just craving attention. They're doing it for attention, which in a sense, you know, isn't a lie. You know, I did the same thing in high school, I was a bully by pulling my kids into something or my friends into something they didn't know how to handle. I was going to the wrong resources, trying to find help from kids who didn't know any better, and it sucked them into the same life I did. But what kids need to know is, you know, when even if it looks like they're looking for attention, you know, give them the attention, not yourself, but find someone like a school counselor or their parents and make sure that somebody who can find the appropriate, you know, resources knows about it so they can get talked to about it and you know, find their coping skills. I mean, you've got to have a coping skill just like with any addiction, you know, being depressed, you know. To me, depression wasn't addiction. It was something I got comfortable with, and I didn't want to get uncomfortable. Finding a job for me after my first time in rehab was hard for me because I didn't want to, you know, live up to expectations. I was so scared of failing, so I stayed depressed. I didn't want to do the things I needed to do. But you can't beat addiction just by quitting. There's no quitting in addiction, realistically. You've got to replace it. And I had to replace my depression with kickboxing. I started kickboxing and working out, just exerting physical exercise and reading and writing as well. Those are my coping skills because you can't just stop doing, you know, self-harm. You can't stop doing drugs. You've got to do something else with that time.
You know what? What too is that I always find too that these parents that are out there now, you know, the idea of, you know, every child needs a trophy kind of idea. Or you must always get up in the morning, oh, hello, good morning, sweetheart, you're the wonderfulest thing in the world. And, this pat on the back really leads to children who are not well-versed in adversity. They're not well-versed in, I made a mistake, or they're not well-versed in hard work. They're not well-versed in accepting a world that's different that is out there. Their parents have created such an illusion and disillusionment of that it's just, kids get up and they're going, what the heck? My parents said it was like candy cotton and lollipops, and it's a real bitch out here. What am I going to do? And that's when they start seeking out other things or other ways or other people to see and experiment around what those are all about, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In Utah especially, and this is where my book starts getting a little sensitive to some of my family members. I'm a very active Mormon. I love my church and that, but I'll be the first to admit that Utah is a bubble. It's a Mormon bubble. I had a lot of, a lot of my bullies went to church with me, and
right.
A lot of the bullying was because I had friends who, drank or smoked, and they live in this world where, you go to church every day, everyone around you is the same religion. You don't get that kind of exposure. And as a young kid, I've always been one to question things. And I always, I never just judged my friends. The friends that I had that drank and smoked were better to me than the kids who didn't. So I chose, to hang out with them. But we lived in this bubble where, their parents are like, and even some of my extended families this way, your friends, don't hang out with that person, or don't date so-and-so. They're not Mormon, or their parents drink, or that could be, they listen to, rap music or something, music that's got foul language in it. I heard a relative of mine actually once try to denounce a date for another relative by saying, no, he listens to songs with swear words. And that just,
right.
The advice that I'd hear my family and people in my church give, their friends, even though they all acted like they were okay with me, they were really just explaining how not to hang out with people like me. And these people hadn't made a mistake. And I saw some of them as they grew up. And luckily, they've had some good friends available, but some of them grew up, and when they did screw up, they were so used to that bubble that there's no coming back in. And that's kind of why I fell away from the church as a kid, is because I was, I'd done some bad things. I'd been with friends who did hard drugs. I'd distributed drugs. I'd had sex before marriage. I'd done a lot of that stuff. And I was like, I'm too far gone. It's not happening. But I've also learned that now I'm a lot more relatable person. And, I actually am a lot better in my church because I went through that and I get it.
And don't you think that society, and I'm in the Catholic Church, or I was, and I grew up, as a Roman Catholic, I think that society and the churches tend to cast out that which is a sin. In other words, if you sinned, you're cast out. And to be able to get back in, you have to do all this repentance, and it's almost like being, I'm going to lash you to the post, and expose all your sins because you're such a bad person, and God will never want you. And I think that that's a real, it's not a good place to be, and I think that's where we're at, is that when you do something that's maybe experiencing the world in another way that others don't believe you should, you end up so far outside of that that, as we said, you can't get back in because their rules and regulations will not allow you to still partake or to feel worthy or to feel human in this world, right? I mean, I saw a sign the other day, we will welcome the Catholics back. I'm going, what the heck? What do you mean welcome us back? Who are you? You're only a church that's a human thing. Did God ever say I'm going to welcome you back? He takes everybody, He's not putting up a sign, if you do repentance, then you can come back in,
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of it, too, is realistically, a lot of the great illusions I had as a kid that I found out is fake. High school never really ends. Even in adult circles and churches, and you get a group of people together, they act like high school kids. There's gossip and that, and they all, to a sense, people become religious extremists. They start, and I've noticed with myself that those that tend to struggle the most with their with their beliefs, or don't really understand it the most, tend to be the most defensive and most willing to outcast someone because they don't want that kind of a contradiction in their life.
Right.
When realistically, with my own experience, you know, the more I invite someone who's, you know, outside of that box, the more I learn about myself and my religion. You know, the more it makes sense to me, because, you know, I mean, that's how it was intended to work. And it's not always the church itself that's, you know, the church itself setting up some guidelines, and then we got people who will take it as, you know, it's black or white, and we don't live in a black or white world, and you can't live like that, or there's no coming back from it.
We look at the Pope, you know, with the, he says, he talks about the pill. We're going, hey, dude, God did not have the pill around then, you know? I mean, get off of your high horse, you know? And sometimes we think, you know, really religion is about a loving and caring entity that feels that you are worthy and you are loved in the world, period. If we strip religion down, that's what it is, any religion, you know?
Oh, yeah, I'm 100%. Behind that, and I actually mentioned that in my book a little bit. I think that's why my family, personally, they're proud of me for writing a book, but a lot of them can't get all the way through it because it is very blunt, and you know, and there's a part in there, there's a kid in there, a gay couple, and the main character in my book's Mormon, but he even talks to one of the kids because they get in a bit of a spout about it, and, you know, he admits in there, and this is the way I feel about it. You know, people make, you know, gays out to be this huge sin, and I have a belief that, you know, that there's a plan and a purpose for why a man's with a woman. But at the same time, I think that, you know, I personally believe that God would slap me across the face a lot harder than he would someone for being gay if I'm going to outcast someone for something they did.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, I've even gotten to the point where there really is no gender to me. I don't see gender. You know, when I see people, and when we say that, oh, that man, he's engaging his feminine side, or that woman, she's engaging her masculine side, and I'm thinking, how silly that is, that comment. Everybody can be everything. There is no gender. If you look at a genderless world, then you're able to just put everybody on an equal playing field. It's when you start putting them in these compartments, like you're religious, you're gender, you know, you're good, you're bad, you're a drug this, you're drug that, you know, you're an ex this or not, that's when we get in trouble, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we put labels on everything too much, and I even saw it a lot, and I'm not going to get into politics, but, I mean, I saw it a lot this election when people were pulling up maps. For some reason, this country feels the need to call out how many of each color of person is voting for who.
Yeah, it's like, what's the point?
I need to know how many people. I don't, you know.
Yeah, see, genderless. Yeah, so what you're doing is you're doing it too. You're taking it, is it just people? It's humans, it's genderless. It's just beings, you know? And I think if we really start looking at it, we won't be pointing the fingers so much. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I think it's hard for people to step out of their box as something they don't understand. And I'm not going to pretend that I understand homosexuality to its fullest, but I do to an extent get it. I mean, there was a point in my junior high where I was, you know, a little bit confused, and I had to decide, because I mean, I'm a firm believer of love everybody, so it makes perfect sense to me.
That's
how
what I'm saying.
You could love somebody, and really it comes down to, you know, where you go after that love, because I think you can, I'm a firm believer you can love anybody, and my religion, you know, kind of, I mean, we got some plans, and it makes sense to me why we'd go one direction, but I'm not going to sit there and, you know, get after somebody who either made a choice or feel they were born a certain way, especially if they're not my religion and don't know things that I believe. Because, I mean, how can you blame someone like that? But people get so scared to let outsiders into their box because they don't want to have to rethink it. They don't want to have to rediscover whether they actually believe what they believe.
Right. And you know what, Jax, too, is that when you think about love, love is a general concept. And then when you think about homosexuality, you're thinking about romantic love. Romantic love is not ever what love really is. So if you take a general love, that's separate from the romantic love. Then you can say everybody is equal and everybody is in that, and you stay in that realm versus having to have judgment into that other part, you know?
Oh,
so
yeah,
really,
definitely.
What you just said is that you look at general love. Everybody does. And I think what is happening is the younger generation now I'm 60, you're a whole lot younger. But what is happening is that that generation has felt that when they use the word love, that it means romantic love or sexual love or love of body, love of drink, love of whatever. You know what I'm saying? Versus that other love of human. In other words, just plain caring about somebody. Do you know what I mean? In a general sense. And we always use that word so freely, and sometimes I think it needs to be talked about. What does that word even mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think part of that, too, I mean, part of the bullying issue that I saw growing up as well, you know, we do have this, you know, gender expectations. And
right.
Even people who, like, are trying to fight for equality, you know, so a lot of them also have these expectations that they can't get over. I mean, I grew up, a lot of my cousins were girls my own age. And I grew up and I was teased for being a little bit feminine.
Right.
Like my favorite movie is The Notebook. I got no problem saying that.
Right.
But as a kid, you know, trying to, you know, I can understand why some people get confused, because you're expected to live up the expectations of you got to be a man, you got to be able to fight, you got to, you know, you can't cry, you know, can't do any of that. But I mean, I'm, you know, after going through, you know, what I went through as a kid, you know, I've come to admit that I'm a lot tougher of a guy now that I'm willing to admit that, you know, I have a feminine side. The most important
right.
people in my life were women. And,
yeah.
you know, I aspire to be more like them than I do a lot of the men in my life. But that doesn't mean anything about, you know, that doesn't make me less of a man because of
that's
that.
That's right.
People have this idea that it does. And that, you know, it scares people.
Yeah, because if we look at it as a genderless type of world with love for everyone, then in that case, there are no rules for that. But then you keep that romantic stuff to the part, or that sexual stuff to the part. That is not even what we're talking about. We're just talking about that love of another person. You know, if you see, you know, your pastor, you might say, man, I love you. You know, I mean, that's the kind. Or your parent, or your cousin, or your sister. You know what I mean? Or
oh,
your
yeah.
dog. You know, that's that genderless love that you have for entities on the world. And I think we just get so wrapped up, you know. I think these millennial kids and maybe those type generation, you know, they grew up with their parents saying, oh, I love you. Oh, everything is great. Everything's hunky-dory. Oh, he loves you. Don't you see? You know, that they use that word in a context and didn't describe it to the children, didn't define it, didn't maybe put it into a context where it was able to be something that they could grow up with. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, they used the word too much, and then the kids, when they grew up as teens, felt that it was that romantic love. They felt that it was sexual love. They felt it was drug love or money love or whatever that might have been. So that was really what got them in trouble. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. It was all about free love then, you know?
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, everything was free sex then. Hey, man. You know, I mean, if you didn't have 10 to 20 people you were sleeping with a year, you better get, you're really slacking, you know? So it was, I think the idea of defining or finding that for yourself and not getting caught up in the other part of it is really where we need to come to.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, I'm seeing it. I think it's completely absurd that I can't, you know, I can't hug a guy
right.
without getting some sort of judgment.
Yeah.
I mean, I got friends that are dudes that, you know, and we have to meet a certain level of friendship before we can hug and it not be
right.
weird. Where girls all the time, you know, they'll hug strangers they've met once before, excited as all get out. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing. But people do grow up with this idea of, you know, love gets thrown around. I'd like to hope a lot of parents don't, but I have seen, you know, some parents throw out love like it's a chore, like they have to remind their kid
yeah.
they love them and they have to say it. But I mean, love is a lot of action more than it is words. So throwing it around becomes a problem. I mean, you got men who it's a part of emotional abuse that women go through a lot. And I mean, I was a part
mm-hmm.
of that as a kid. You know, you throw I love you around as part of, you know, part of your plan to get laid, realistically.
Yeah.
And you do it because girls, you know, some of the girls you run into are, you know, they're more emotional or you feel that way. Realistically, I don't think they are because I know how emotional I can get. And like, but I'm
mm-hmm.
not going to admit that like a woman would. And a woman, you know, more the women in my life are more willing to admit I don't want to just sleep with a guy. So So a guy has to, you know, start pretending they care. And it's not right. But we grow up with this, you know, I love you, the pro. Like, it's not, we don't even know. Like, it's so around the board now, I think.
Right. It's like, you know, they throw the word around like it means everything and nothing, you know. Let's talk for a little bit, you know, in closing. We got about 8 more minutes. This really disregard for the human person. I'm seeing it a lot with gangs. I'm seeing a lot with the generation between the ages of, I would probably say, 9 to up to maybe 26, 27-year-olds. And it's like with the gangs here, you know, throwing the women out of the car, shooting them, stuffing them in garbage cans, killing parents, different things like that. So what is this real disregard that has come up that you might have encountered or felt or sensed? Because it's really a disregard for the human as a person. And how in their life could they have felt so disconnected that they have to go that other way?
Well, I got a pretty weird example of that in my own life, but I think part of it is, you know, you want to fit in so much with a certain group of people that you don't admit that these other people you're hurting to impress your group of friends are people too. For instance, I never actively took drugs or drank. I had a lot of friends that did. But when I was 13, after selling with a crew in Ogden that I'd met when I was a kid, I went to a party. And me not, you know, being the Mormon kid who didn't drink or do drugs, I had to really live up to show these guys, you know, what it was like to, or how to have fun, because they didn't believe I could, because I didn't, you know, get high and drink with them. But one of them, and I had sold or slung crack and methamphetamine for quite a while now without knowing what it was, because I was a kid and I was just, you know, I was just a mule for them. But they hung out with me because I was doing it and wasn't asking questions. I just wanted to fit in and thought it was cool that the other kids liked me. But I had a friend of mine who came in with probably about a quarter size white rock of some crack, and he had talked me into eating it. He had told me that this other friend of ours had offered him, you know, half pound of weed if he could talk me into eating it. And he just told me it was something they found in the fridge, because I was like, what is it? And they didn't want to tell me. They were just trying to see if I'd eat it. Right. And I ate it. And I remember going, we call it a flash blind. Lights start getting real heavy on you, and then you just don't see anything but white and some, you know, specks. And I don't know what happened exactly right after that, but I remember coming to in his yard. And when I went to the house, and these were my best friends at the time. And their disregard for my life was pretty ridiculous. I go in there, and my buddy's excited to see I'm alive, and starts telling me how they had this elaborate plan to tell the cops that I was hopping fences in the yard, and they had found me, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do. But it was all about, you know, that party life, and that's a big deal now. Yeah. You know, people just want to be cool and do something crazy. And they all feel sad when their friends, you know, die. You know, I had a lot of friends die in high school as well, but you see these same kids, you see their friends go with drugs, but then they go right back into the same lifestyle, and they don't take it. They don't own the fact that they influenced that, you know. They feel bad their friends OD'd, and then they don't take ownership for the fact that they, you know, they either got on the drugs or they were doing drugs with them, even though they knew it was a problem.
And yeah, it's almost the idea of so what. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They live a so what kind of life. No matter what they did, it's like, yeah, so what? You know? Or you killed somebody. Yeah, so what? You know? Oh, you know, you just stole from them. So what? You know? You just had a baby and you just threw it out. Yeah, so what? It's almost a so what kind of life, and you wonder where that comes from, you know?
Yeah, part of it is, you know, like I said a little earlier, you know, parents don't want to admit to their that their kids are the bad kid in school, and these kids grow up never taking ownership for what they do. So when these things happen, and it is, you know, even if it's not 100% their fault, I had an ex-girlfriend who had killed herself, and I had a part of that. You know, part of the conversation that led up to that, you know, I was involved in, and I didn't do anything to help.
Right.
And I live with that every day, but, I mean, part of the reason, you know, I'm a better person today is because I owned up to the fact that, you know, I did have an influence on that. I didn't go home and cry about it and say there's nothing I could do. There were some very real things I could have done, and whether that would have stopped it in the long run or not, I don't know. But I do know there were some actions that I chose not to take, which may have helped. And, you know, that ownership a lot of people don't have anymore. They just don't want to admit that, you know, part of it may be their fault. And you don't ever want to live with that guilt and mope about it for the rest of your life. But in order to grow, you've got to admit that, you know, you could have done something. And are you going to do something next time? Or are you just going to keep letting this happen to you?
And I think that ownership right there where you said, where you're expecting the children to have ownership, it's the parents that don't have ownership that they've got a problem child. Our parents that say, oh, well, it's my teen. I'm not going to, you know, I gave him his personal space, or I allowed him to do that because he's growing up and he should have his own room and he should have his own phone and he should be able to this and he should be able to that. He is going to be an adult and I'm giving him responsibilities, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, I mean, even I myself, you know, cleaning out the closet and, you know, the shoes tip over and the inner sole comes out and there's a little hole cut in the bottom where all the drugs go, you know, or, you know, all of these different things. You know, I had a friend the other day said, oh, somebody said something to me about my kid, and I went in his room and he had a safe in there. So I blowtorched it to get it open. And inside that one safe was another safe, and I blowtorched that to get open. And when I got inside the two safes, there was all of these oils and everything and all this money. Oh, my kid is selling essential oils. That's just really weird. He must just be an entrepreneur. And we're thinking, how much of a butthole is this parent? Because those oils are carriers for drugs, you know? And and it's like I'm thinking, are you seriously that dumb, you know? And different things, and you just, you know, and they're just like, oh, well, I just call my kid an entrepreneur. He's doing it in the playground. And I'm going, oh, my gosh. So really, when we say about the kids are, you know, taking responsibility, parents need to take responsibility. Until the kid is 18 years old and one day, you better be knowing what's going on in their bedroom. You better be knowing what's on in the car. You need to pull out the, you know, the wheel wells in the vehicle. You need to look underneath the front tires to see what's magnetically being held there. You need to be a real pain in the butt. You need to know what's inside of that water bottle they're taking every day, you know, stuff like that, you know. People do not investigate, and they just let it go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these kids grow up not knowing what trust is because parents, you know, just give it out freely. That's one thing I think my parents did real good with me, because my dad was a cop. And he, you know, when I got in trouble, every time I got arrested, it wasn't because the cops were taking me in. It was because my dad caught me and turned me in. Because he knew that, you know, I was just going to turn into a schmuck if I didn't, you know, live and suffer the consequences. And I actually almost got sent to prison for it as a kid, like 16 years old. They were talking to me about 10 plus years. And they actually called my dad, you know, are you sure you want to do this? This is a big deal. And my dad, you know, that was probably the scariest moment of my life, just said, no, he's done it. I'm not dealing with this.
Yep.
But, I mean, then I knew at that point, you know, I can't keep doing this because, you know, they're not going to put up with me screwing up and bail me out. It's me or nobody.
Yeah, and then parents are just so oblivious to it, you know, and we even look at that, why is this opioids so bad and then kids go into heroin? It's because what do you think the parents had in their medicine cabinets, you know, or their purses or whatever? They're, you know, parents carrying around a flask is really, in this city, they do that, and it's like, what the heck, you know? Or some of the politicians, oh, yeah, well, you know, he's drunk as a skunk, you know, up there, and, you know, he only comes in once a day to the Senate or whatever because he's drunk as heck. Or some of the other politicians, you know, their kids underage, 15, 16, 17, they're going to bail them out because they just drove drunk down the street and wrecked about 10 cars, you know, and nothing gets said about it. It's always pushed under the covers, you know, instead of being an expose, you know?
Oh, yeah, and it doesn't mean that, I mean, kids make mistakes. Adults make mistakes. Everyone does.
Yeah.
So admitting to them shouldn't be as scary to people as they treat it like this. I mean, it's an opportunity to learn, no matter how bad it is. I mean, I've met people who have screwed up pretty bad who have turned their life around. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that, I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do in this world that you can't come back from if you've got the right mindset for it and you're willing to do it.
Right, but you should wear that badge of that just to tell someone else, you know?
Yeah, you got to be willing to admit you came from somewhere, you know, a little darker. And, you know, I think I've part of the reason my wife and I have a great relationship is because I was pretty honest with her when I first met her about where I'm coming from.
Right.
And, you know, all my good friends, you know, I was the ones that I kept after high school that were there for me in high school. I was willing to admit, you know, this is what I need to change. I'm not doing this. And, you know, when I stopped hanging out with them for a while, I told them why. And they were the ones that were willing to say, you know what, you're right. You know, figure yourself out. I'll figure me out. Let's get back together and keep
mm-hmm.
each other on track. But you got to be able to admit that, you know, you've made some mistakes and you got to work on it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very tough to grow up these days. You know, it's just the time and it's the age and it's what's going on in the world. But it also is we're more intelligent people. We should be able to keep up with it. So I really think shows like this is really necessary because you've got to stand up. You've got to be, you got to live a life with eyes wide open at any age and be able to see what's going on and how to help each other, because that's really what we're all here for. Jax, I'm really thankful that you came on the show and shared your stories. I think that is seriously important. And also about your book, Semi-Viral, it definitely is a good read. And I think it should be all shared around. And I really, really am very proud of that you're able to stand up today and say, you know, I own it. And I think that's really a great thing to be able to do.
Right, now, thank you for having me on, Dr. Ned. I really appreciate being here. And, you know, like I said, I really want to share this message with anybody it can help, you know.
Right.
I think it's important to know that there are other people who have been through it. And, you know, I made it. I'm doing well right now. I've got a career. I've got a wife and a daughter. People can turn around and they can make it.
Absolutely. Well, Jax, you know, I'm going to have you on again. I'm holding you to this. In the summer, you're going to come back on and we're going to talk about this again, because I think it is a topic that you can never talk about enough. And, you know, share stories, share thoughts, share lives, and really that's what the best part. So you're going to come back on in June, yes?
Absolutely. I can do that.
Very good. Well, Jax, can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about you? That would be great.
So right now I'm working on building the website, but I do have a Blogspot account. It's called Young Suburbia at blogspot.com or Facebook. Semi-Viral's got a Facebook page. You can look that up. And my Goodreads account as well. So Goodreads, Semi-Viral on Facebook, and Young Suburbia, blogspot.com.
Well, that's really great, Jax. Thank you so much for joining us, and I really think it's really important to share the story, and thank you for stepping up to do that.
All right. No, thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Great. If you'd like to find out more information about Jax Anderson, again, the book is Semi-Viral, please do check out the links and the information on the bottom of today's show page. I encourage you, if you are a parent, you must take care of your children up till the age of 18 years and one day. You know, to step away and step out, you never know. You could have saved a life. Really do pay attention. And for you who may be challenging your life a little bit more, ask for help. Reach out. Because you know what? Everybody does care. You may not think it will come in the form that you may be expecting, but, you know, search. You'll find help. And if you don't find help, you know, message Jax, message myself, message someone, step up, step out. I think you will find some help that is out there. So thank you so much for joining us today. And until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.